Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Okay, so let's unpack this one. Today, we're doing a deep dive into a novel that, well, it pretty much redefined a narrative structure in psychological realism, Ford Madox Ford's 1915 masterpiece, The Good Soldier.
Absolutely foundational.
Right. If you want a shortcut into understanding the DNA of literary modernism, this is kind of it.
It really is.
So our mission here is to excavate the source material to see how 9 years of civilized life between two supposedly friendly couples could build a foundation so rotten it just collapses into total catastrophe.
It's just the ultimate dissection, isn't it? The lie at the very heart of Edwardian propriety. And the book tells you right away, with that famous and maybe famously misleading opening line, This is the saddest story I have ever heard. You've got the wealthy American Dowells, the aristocratic English Ashburnhams, living this really quite exquisite parallel life. Dinner parties, polite chats, spa visits, all very smooth.
Deceptively smooth.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And yet, by the end, that entire polished facade is just shattered. Adultery, suicide, madness, it's all there. The core conflict, the thing we really have to get our heads around, is the narrator's staggering, almost willful blindness. John Dowell.
Yeah.
How could he have been so wrong? I mean, so wrong about the people closest to him for nearly a decade.
Well, that blindness is key, isn't it? It's intentional, I think, both for Dowell, the character, and for us, the readers. And to understand why the story is told in this, you know, confusing, fragmented way, we need to talk about the man who wrote it, Ford Madox Ford. He wasn't just a novelist. He was more like a cultural architect of the whole period, a really pivotal figure editing these hugely influential magazines, the English Review, Transatlantic Review.
Where he championed all the new voices.
Exactly. The James Joyces, the Ezra Pounds, Ernest Hemingway. He was basically the bridge, wasn't he, between that heavy Victorian style and the, well, the chaos and experimentation of modernism.
He wasn't just watching the change happen. He was practically drawing up the blueprints for it.
Precisely. And his own literary philosophy, which he actually called impressionism in fiction, that dictates the entire experience of reading The Good Soldier.
Right.
Ford believed that fiction had to prioritize psychological reality over, you know, neat ABC chronology.
Which isn't how our minds work anyway.
Not at all. When we remember something important, we don't start neatly at the beginning. We jump around associatively, right? Connect a feeling now to something that happened years ago, then a memory of a sound back again.
So instead of a simple timeline, the narrative feels more like a map of someone's memory, full of gaps, sudden connections, these revelations that pop up out of sequence.
Yeah, and it forces you, the listener, to constantly piece together the truth right alongside Dowell, who's confused himself.
It's incredibly modern, that way of storytelling. It respects the, well, the messiness of the human mind.
And chaos is definitely the word here, especially when you consider the title itself. You mentioned the original title was simply The Saddest Story, but the publisher pushed for a change to The Good Soldier. In 1915, right in the middle of World War I.
And that renaming is just a stroke of maybe accidental genius irony.
Totally.
Because The Good Soldier makes you think of nobility, duty, British virtue, right? The ideal. But then you look at Captain Edward Ashburnham, the man himself, and you find someone who sticks rigidly to this outdated code of honor.
While simultaneously.
While portraying basically every personal relationship he has, the clash between that expected nobility and the moral rot inside just sets the stage perfectly for the whole tragic farce.
So let's settle into that tragic stage then. It's set, as you said, in this comfortable, very privileged world. Edwardian upper class, often in that German spa town, Bad Nauheim, where wealthy people went, supposedly, for their health cures.
Oh, Nauheim. It's almost like another character, isn't it? A place of leisure, relaxation, but crucially, of social ritual.
Yes, the ritual.
Their lives are described as this placid minuet, this incredibly careful dance of polite conversation. Everything ordered, nothing really sincere underneath.
And that ritual is essential.
Right.
Because it masks everything.
It's the perfect cover for all the emotional corruption and betrayal simmering below. If everyone stays polite, if no one asks the awkward questions, the lie can just continue. Forever, almost.
And the absolute centerpiece of that lie involves John Dowell and his wife, Florence. Dowell, our wealthy, passive American narrator, he believes his wife has a weak heart.
Right, which very conveniently means they need emotional and physical distance.
Convenient is the word.
Because it's all a fabrication.
Yeah.
Florence's heart condition is this masterful 9-year-long manipulation. It's just a tool.
A tool to control Dowell.
Yes, keep him at arm's length emotionally while she carries on this long-term affair with Captain Edward Ashburnham.
Sure.
That fake illness. It's like a symbol for the whole era, really. This
yeah.
delicate, fragile appearance masking a very robust, calculating selfishness.
So the novel becomes this meditation on, well, the sheer impossibility of ever truly knowing another person.
Mm.
And the devastating results when we prefer comfortable illusions over difficult, maybe ugly truths.
And that challenge is put right onto you, the listener, because you're trapped inside Dowell's head. He even tells you he doesn't know the truth, even as he's trying to tell the story. It's bewildering.
So let's maybe pull these four central figures onto the stage properly and see how their specific paradoxes fuel the collapse. Dowell first. The analyst described him as the archetypal innocent abroad, but is he really that innocent?
That's the question, isn't it? Is it genuine innocence? Or is it more like what the source material calls willful blindness, a deliberate choice?
I lean towards choice. I think he chooses the lie because, well, the lie is easier. It's more comfortable.
Right. Better to be the caring husband of a delicate invalid.
Than to face the messy truth about his wife's deception. So he's not just passively observing. He's actively participating in his own delusion, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
His awakening, when it comes, is painful, incomplete, and it only happens after everything's already smashed to pieces, leaving him just hollowed out, the guardian of the ruins.
And then there's Edward Ashburnham, the good soldier himself. He's, on the surface, incredibly appealing. Charming, devoted to duty in a military sense, kind to servants, generous.
All the outward signs of a good man.
Exactly. But he's also utterly destructive. He lives by this rigid gentleman's code, yet that very code seems to be what enables his endless disastrous affairs.
That's the core paradox for him, isn't it? This compulsive need for romantic passion.
Yes.
But his code means he can never really integrate those passions honestly into his life, his marriage, his sense of duty.
And his affairs aren't just, you know, casual flings. They seem driven by this genuine, if totally misguided sentimentalism.
Yeah.
He seems to actually believe he's loving these women, helping them.
Even as he's systematically ruining their lives and eventually his own.
Precisely. And then you have the wives, Leonora Ashburnham and Florence Dowell, sort of the pragmatic survivor versus the selfish manipulator.
Let's talk Florence first. As we said, she uses that fake illness brilliantly for 9 years, gives her social cover, maximum freedom for her affair with Edward. She's calculated, selfish, profoundly dishonest.
And her suicide.
Yeah.
Which Dowell initially thinks is just her heart finally giving out.
Right.
It's the ultimate act of control, isn't it? It's poison.
Yeah.
And it's triggered only when she realizes she's lost her grip on Edward's attention. When she loses control.
Then there's Leonora, Edward's wife. Her tragedy is different, maybe colder. Because she's devoutly Catholic, divorce isn't an option, so her entire adult life becomes this exercise in damage control.
She just transforms, doesn't she? Into this hardened, pragmatic survivor, relentlessly managing Edward's affairs, his terrible finances, all to preserve their social standing.
She's maybe the moral center in that she sees the truth of the situation, but her cold calculation and just maintaining appearances, it ends up being almost as destructive as Florence's act of deception.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She sacrifices her own soul, really, her own passion, just to keep the form of their marriage intact. It shows the huge personal cost of upholding that Edwardian social propriety above all else.
Okay, so that shift in control, when Edward's focus moves decisively to a new woman, that's the psychological trigger for the whole plot finally unraveling. And we have to follow it assertively, like Dowell tells it. Not a straight line, but these key moments.
Right. It's like a series of explosions. The first real crack, I think, is the Maisie Maiden crisis. Maisie was another of Edward's lovers.
Conveniently also with a supposed heart condition.
Exactly. Just like Florence. And Maisie dies suddenly in Nauheim. Florence witnesses Edward's reaction, his genuine, intense grief for Maisie.
Grief she never got from him.
Precisely. And that realization, that jealousy, it just fuels her desperation. It starts the clock ticking on her own downfall.
But the situation gets far more dangerous with the arrival of the Nancy Rufford catalyst. Nancy is the Ashburnham's young ward, very innocent.
And this is where Edward changes. He stops being just a sentimental philanderer and develops this genuine, deep, pure love for Nancy.
A love he sees as maybe redemptive, his last chance.
Perhaps. A chance for true happiness. But this purity, this intensity, it's something Florence knows she can never compete with. And that triggers the climax.
Florence takes the poison.
Realizing she's truly, finally lost Edward. Suicide.
The aftermath is just brutal and immediate.
Utterly devastating. Leonora, pushed absolutely to her limit by jealousy, despair over Edward's sincere love for Nancy. She decides she has to destroy Nancy's innocence before Edward can have her.
So cruel.
She tells Nancy everything, every sordid detail of Edward's past affairs, shatters the girl's entire world right before they send her away to India.
And that leads directly to Edward's end, his final terrible adherence to his code.
He can't reconcile his intense, real love for the now shattered Nancy with his own sense of failure, his broken code.
Oh.
So he cuts his own throat with a penknife.
An act that feels both honorable in his twisted logic and completely futile.
Utterly. And the news. First of Edward's love, then immediately of his violent death.
Mm-hmm.
It reaches Nancy on her voyage.
And her mind just snaps.
The shock is just too much. It leads to her irreversible psychological breakdown. She descends into the state of permanent madness, repeating fragments, unable to process a truth that's just too devastating for a human mind to bear.
Which leaves John Dowell, the one man left standing amidst the moral carnage.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up as Nancy's guardian, living in the very house where it all fell apart. This hollowed-out man, alone with the truth, as the source says, but unable to communicate it to Nancy, the one person who needs it, or perhaps is now incapable of ever hearing it.
Such an image of profound, endless isolation.
Yeah, and this whole narrative really brings us back to that dominant theme, doesn't it? The impossibility of true knowledge.
That quote.
Dowell's unforgettable, chilling line, "The heart of another is a dark forest." It's not just about betrayal, it's about the inherent limits of our understanding. We only ever get impressions, right? Never the full reality of another person's soul.
And what Nancy Rufford's fate seems to suggest is that sometimes, maybe often, the truth itself is just too destructive.
Yeah, exposing the darkness might break the person. Her madness feels like Ford's most devastating judgment on the actual cost of all this deception.
It also feels like Ford's wider critique of the failure of social conventions, that Edwardian upper class world they lived in.
Yeah.
It prioritized appearance over reality, politeness over honesty.
Absolutely. And that system protected manipulators like Florence.
And it stopped Edward and Leonora from ever having the brutally honest confrontation that just maybe might have averted the final tragedy. The social structure itself became an accomplice to the destruction.
Which might be why Dowell makes that subtle but really crucial distinction near the beginning,
yeah,
between sadness and tragedy.
All right.
He says he calls it the saddest story rather than the most tragic because it is not a story of inevitable doom.
Not fate.
No. It is a story of how human beings can make mistakes. It wasn't destiny that destroyed them. It was this accumulation of preventable errors, selfish choices, and just a profound shared failure of moral courage. The courage to look the truth squarely in the eye.
The novel really teaches us that the biggest tragedies often spring not from outright malice, but from that inability to look honestly into another's heart, or maybe even more dangerously, into our own.
Its legacy, I think, lies in showing how the quiet, civilized confines of a marriage of polite society can contain a chaos far deeper and more destructive than any battlefield. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.